Hi, my name is Kirk Kinder, and this is Saving Yourself from Wall Street, the podcast for people who want to avoid Wall Street's sales tactics, high cost, and conflicted advice so they can take control of their financial life. So let's get to it. Today I'm going to interview one of my best friends, Cale Smith. Cale is the founder of Isla Mirada Investment Management. He started that back up in 2008, and right now he manages two of their funds, the Tarpon and Gecko funds. Now, if you've ever been to Isla Mirada down in the Florida Keys, you're going to understand exactly how Cale came up with the name for those funds. But along with that, Cale also created the Spoke Fund model of portfolio management. It's a very unique, client-centric way to manage money. Prior to starting his firm, Cale served as a managing director of an investor relations firm, the director of research at an independent research firm, and the lead equity analyst for another independent research firm near Washington, D.C. He has also served as an analyst at a hedge fund. So Cale's got a pretty wide variety of investor relations background. He's also an honors graduate of the U.S. Coast Guard Academy, where he majored in business management. He received his MBA from the College of William & Mary, and Cale even competed for the Olympics in rowing as a single sculler. Along with his professional accomplishments, Cale's actively involved down in the Florida Keys community. He serves as a treasurer on the board of directors of the Florida Keys Electric Cooperative. Please don't contact him if you have a question on your bill, though. He's also the director on the operating board of the Mariners Hospital down there. He's on the investment committee for the Baptist Health South Florida, which oversees about $2.7 billion of assets. So Cale and I were classmates at the academy, and we were stationed together out in Honolulu, Hawaii. So trust me when I tell you Cale's a wicked smart guy. I think you're really going to enjoy this interview. Now here's Cale Smith. All right, Cale, well, thanks for being part of the podcast.
Yeah, happy to be here.
Yeah, so, you know, for everybody listening in, Cale and I have a long and distinguished history together in the Coast Guard. Maybe not distinguished, but long, I guess.
Yeah, that's right.
But yeah, Cale, so, you know, I'm hoping maybe you could just talk to folks. You know, they might wonder how does somebody go from being, you know, Coast Guard officer to a money manager. So how did your path kind of develop?
Yeah, boy, good question. It was non-traditional or untraditional, I guess. The shorter version, I suppose, is that I realized before I eventually left the Coast Guard, I was getting my MBA at night, and during those MBA classes, heard about this guy, Warren Buffett. And it was quite the contrast in those classes too, right? Because you'd have MBA sort of style finance classes are really all about the professors really rehashing something called efficient market theory, which in a nutshell is, well, here's why mathematically speaking, you shouldn't even try to attempt to beat the market. And so we'd have these sort of long detailed discussions about that in class. And then, you know, you kind of step out of class and I remember seeing, I think it was in a Barnes & Noble, either a Business Week or something, with this guy Warren Buffett on the cover, who was basically doing everything exactly the opposite of what the MBA professors were doing, and just kind of stepping back and saying, all right, well, you know, my professor's driving the whatever 93 Corolla to class every day, and this guy Buffett at the time was worth $20 billion. I think I'm going to maybe start paying a little bit more attention to his approach and style. Just weighing all the evidence objectively, you know?
Yeah. Even though Buffett probably himself drives a Corolla or a very low key. He's not a big flashy guy, but
exactly. Yeah,
I get your point. Yeah.
You know, let's just see whose advice is really going to be that much more sort of intellectually interesting, I guess.
And
that was the irony too of getting that MBA is that it was really, I guess that time period is when I first started getting any sort of interest in investing per se, but that was really as a result of almost the sort of, you know, autodidactic approach of just learning a lot about Buffett. It was a total bummer trying to, you know, figure out if that was the right field or not, just based on classes you take at night. It was, I guess that was the genesis of it. And then at that point, got out of the Coast Guard, knew that's kind of what I wanted to do. But, and you can appreciate this too, being able to drive, a 1,000-ton ship all over Central Pacific doesn't necessarily hold a lot of weight with people in the finance industry when it shows up on their desk in a resume. So it felt like it took a while to, I think in the investing world, sort of value investing in particular, it's a fairly kind of a small circle of firms, number one, that do it well, and that number two would entertain, even bringing on as an intern someone who at that point had my background. So I felt like it took a little while to really get a foothold in the industry. And in the meantime, had actually another one of our Coast Guard buddies was working in telecom. So I managed a couple of telecom projects and I guess gained a little bit of knowledge, just enough to be dangerous there for a couple of years before finally kind of being able to make the transition. And the irony was when I finally kind of made it into the investing industry at this little hedge fund there in DC, it was that telecom background that I think probably at least helped distinguish me on the resume front and maybe helped get me in the door. So. And then it was, that was whatever, 15, 16 years ago and kind of off to the races after that. A sort of circular, non-traditional path. I think there's just core elements that probably, I think, as you found too, probably there's things about being a Coast Guard officer just in terms of the operational side of the house that translate to other fields and running a small business, I'd like to think, is one of them. And there's a whole other discussion, I suppose, in there somewhere. But that's the slightly longer than short version of however that path wound its way to today.
Yeah, well, tell us a little bit about what kind of funds you're managing at Islamorada Investment Management. So what are you guys focused on?
Yeah, so I spend most of my time managing two portfolios, essentially. And I have one that's a long-term capital appreciation fund portfolio. It's called Tarpinfolio. That was kind of our flagship portfolio, if you will, the one that I started really the firm with. And then also run what is a U.S. Equity income fund as well. So something that was designed originally for some investors who want a little bit more yield as opposed to growth. And we've been doing this for about 10 years now, as of the summer. And over time, we're starting to, there's three of us here now, got some really fantastic business partner. We've got a new operations manager as well. So as the firm has grown, we're starting to branch out a little bit. So it's less specifically about those two portfolios, and now we've got three other international portfolios and doing a little bit more, I don't want to say traditional wealth management or asset allocation, but there's just certain people who it might not be appropriate for them to put all of their money into, my semi-volatile Tarpon fund, and okay, what are some low-cost ETF options that we might consider, that sort of thing.
Okay.
But yeah, we're kind of making that transition from a real specialized investment portfolio focus shop into offering some other things as well. But yeah, I mean, my emphasis and I guess my heart and soul are really in the good old fashioned stock picking side of the house for sure still.
So yeah, so it's pretty obvious, talking about Buffett and, you're clearly trying to be a value investor. Mm-hmm. And so, outside of the influence of Buffett, what kind of drive you to focus on value?
Yeah, I think it's just almost a little different, more of a maybe even a worldview than just a way to sort of try to hack or beat the market. I mean, it's a in terms of value investing, right? It's probably the big distinguishing belief or principle is that, all right, every company has an inherent value to it or an intrinsic value. And that's really right out of the Buffett playbook. There is a concrete number that approximates what a company is worth. and that you can get some confidence in via, you know, certain analytical tools like a discounted cash flow analysis, that sort of thing. So I guess it sort of resonated with me, that approach to investing, because it is fairly objective. It's, you know, again, based primarily on the numbers, and you're essentially trying to find stocks that the market is overlooking, or sort of more specifically that the market is pricing significantly less than the actual numbers might say it's actually worth. So, you know, to simplify quite a lot, if that true value or that, you know, that intrinsic value is greater than what the market thinks it's worth, then that's something that, all right, that might be really something considering looking further at and or buying as you peel back a little bit. So I guess I just like the objectivity of it. You could really point to somebody like a Buffett, say, clearly, you know, this works or it can work if done well. Here's a great example of it. And it's also, I guess, maybe a little bit of the contrarian in me like that approach at some level too. You know, if you approach or if you contrast that value investing approach with what, at least for the last few years anyways, seems to be the more dominant element of investing, i.e. the growth investing, right? It's mm-hmm. Growth investors in general are typically a lot more concerned about the story behind a stock, or maybe the possibility of a future that can't really be seen yet. And the idea of value investing just seemed a little bit more grounded to me. And frankly, you know, in theory would be a lot safer. One of the big concepts that would, you know, distinguish somebody who is a value investor from a growth investor is the whole idea of margin of safety, which again is right out of that Buffett playbook. So, you know, if you apply that principle of margin of safety correctly, then, you know, in theory, that should help ensure that your investment resulted in positive returns. If you, you know, if you want a 20% margin of safety on a stock before you buy it, then, you know, just to keep the math simple, if you would be looking to buy a stock that had an intrinsic value of $100 a share at a price of $80 per share or less. So that sort of kind of framework, that analytical framework, just made a lot of sense to me originally. And it's probably a little bit of a cliche. I think it either makes sense to you right away and you just kind of go down that path the rest of your career, or it doesn't, and you kind of look at other frameworks, other styles that might appeal to you. But value was certainly one that I sort of bought into early on and then some.
And when you approach looking at opportunities, are you basically using the Benjamin Graham who influenced Buffett? Are you just looking at Graham analysis, or what's your investment approach as you look at opportunities?
Yeah, it's a good question too. I think it's the short version is it has changed over time. You know, this is 10 years of doing this at this point, but I'm not necessarily convinced at all that the analytical tools that Ben Graham had available really would necessarily work at all today. And part of it is because, all right, those tools and that strategy, you know, which at one point was proven to be pretty successful, that success is going to attract competitors and really, in theory anyways, minimize or even eliminate, you know, using that sort of strategy to outperform. And I think to some extent you could say the same about Buffett in general. I mean, I think, you know, his framework, and the ability to objectively assess, you know, what a company's cash flows might be, the ability to not get emotionally over-involved one way or the other, I think that kind of framework is hugely important as an investor. But when it comes to the tools in general, I think you sort of have to adapt. I'm not sure that, you know, and well, frankly, if you just look at Berkshire Hathaway the last 10 years, you could say that, all right, well, Buffett, as probably the most well-known value investor, certainly hasn't been able to keep up with the market's rise. And then you've got, you know, some of these other less known but equally well-respected, I guess, hedge fund guys who are value investors who are having a tough go of it lately. I think it speaks to more being able to kind of adapt and modify your approach as well. So on the Buffett front, yeah, his framework is hugely important, I think, just as an investor, but the tools are different. And you know, he also, I think, would say the same about Ben Graham. He started as a Graham guy, saw it wasn't necessarily as advantageous a strategy as it was originally. And there's a whole other discussion there, which maybe we could even get into about, okay, well, what does it mean to be a value investor today? And where does that take you? And you know, how do you apply this general strategy in a world where, you know, there's a whole lot more algorithmic trading every day? The market seems to move a whole lot faster, that sort of thing.
Well, I would think, you know, if you're a value investor and you can identify something that's below its intrinsic value, it's at some point, even with, you know, the high frequency trading and all the different arbitrage you're trying to, you're still going to come out okay at some point, right? The whole Buffett, the weighing machine and all that. So at some point, it seems like you'd still be okay. I mean, do you think that, or?
Yeah, I do. I think, you know, there's probably a general sort of cyclicality to it. It's been, I think, the last 10 years, just given, you know, the run the market has had, I think it has been sort of harder to be that sort of Buffett style value investor. I think the cycle will probably turn again at some point. Relatively soon, I would guess. But having that analytical approach of, you know, that margin of safety and still looking at the fundamentals, while it seems like there's not a lot of other folks out there these days doing it, you know, I'm still fairly convinced that there is, you know, some really good and compelling opportunities out there. It just means, okay, maybe we're not looking for, you know, the quote unquote compounders like we used to be able to 5-10 years ago. But because of that high frequency trading, because of the algorithms, I find myself getting led to other areas of the market where, frankly, you know, you can't necessarily be beaten to an idea by an algorithm. You know, it is in general smaller companies where things may not be as traded as frequently, looking at opportunities where, you know, it's a little bit more complicated than just sitting back and predicting, all right, well, what are their earnings going to look like? What should their earnings power be? And that's a big difference, I think, between Buffett's heyday and today as well. Anything, any financial data that can be sort of captured and encoded in an algorithm, I mean, anything coming out of the financials that the company's publishing, I think those opportunities will still exist. But it's just going to entail either a little bit more digging and or finding something that, you know, the algos can't necessarily pick up as quickly or should not be as confident in, if that makes any sense. So yeah, I think there's still a lot of merit to it, even though it's kind of out of favor at this point. But, you know, I would guess that cycle will shift before too long as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And you've kind of referenced it. I mean, anything with growth has been the place to be, and value clearly hasn't. And, you know, if you look at the charts, performance of growth versus value is back to where it was essentially in 2000, right before the tech bubble burst back then. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, if you haven't been in the fangs, you know, Facebook, Amazon, Apple, Google, Netflix, you've been getting slaughtered. So it's at some point, I think it's got to flip. What do you think might actually eventually cause people to stop? Like you mentioned growth, they're buying the story. So at what point do you think that the story is no longer going to be the selling point? I mean, I just looked at, Netflix's, recent earnings. At first they loved it 'cause they had almost 7 million new members, but yet they burned $800 billion in the quarter. I mean, at some point you're going to run out of cash. But at what point are the investors going to come back to, I guess, to sanity? What do you think might prompt that?
Yeah, I think that cycle will probably turn again. Well, eventually, it always has. So I suspect it always will. The timing of it is really the tough part, right? I mean, if nothing else, certainly a recession or general slowdown would probably do it. But, you know, that's almost a little too much of a sort of a nihilist or curmudgeonly approach to life to say, yeah, you know, my strategy will work great again as long as it starts to hit the fan out there. I think, and kind of what you're getting at, I think, is that I suspect it's going to be more valuation driven. Specifically, you know, once the gap between, say, those FANG stocks, those tech stocks that get way overvalued, and say, for instance, energy stocks, which are currently really undervalued, once that gap between those two sectors gets too wide, then I do have faith that the market is still rational, and you know, that cycle will start to change. People will just at some point the gap becomes too obvious, and all right, paying, you know, put your crazy multiple in there, 50 times earnings for Netflix versus, you know, buying some of these offshore drillers that are at a third of book value. At some point, you know, the analysis changes, and I suspect it will probably be a notable shift. When that happens, well, that's anybody's guess. But I don't know that we necessarily need to be in that game of guessing timing either, as long as you know, we're just being sensitive to how other people think about both sides of that for now.
Yeah, and you know, I'm sure for you, it's got to be tough because, you know, investors anchor to whether it's the S&P 500. Or some other measurement, you know, value clearly has worked over time, but nobody can tell when it's going to work, just that it does. So, you know, you end up having kind of unhappy investors for a while. You just try to educate folks to keep them, to let them know, hey, you know, I can't control the timing here, but I've got sort of history on my side. Is that sort of the approach or?
Yeah, I think it is. It's a couple things, and you're absolutely right. I feel like there's to call yourself a value investor is one thing, but equally as important is to have other investors, you know, that are your clients who also sort of buy into that general feeling, right? Like I could talk all day about, you know, buying these undervalued companies and just being patient and waiting, but you know, you as a portfolio manager, you can't necessarily do that if your investors are calling up every day and screaming and yelling and wonder why, you know, why we're underperforming. So started back in 08 and through the end of 2016, we're basically matched up with S&P 500 returns. This is in Tarpon Light, my main portfolio. So through then, you know, we had some very strong returns. Last year was tough because we were and still are in Tarpon very energy focused, oil company specific focused. And, you know, broader market was up, what, 30%. Oil companies got hammered again. So, yeah, it's been a process of trying to keep everybody educated on really here's why I'm thinking the way I am. Here's the, objectively speaking, here's the evidence I'm seeing behind, you know, both the macro side of why I think oil should be trading a lot higher. Here's some details about the companies that we own and how there's, while it might not be obvious, there are actually margins of safety built into these companies, in which case then it really just becomes a question of patience and being able to tolerate the ups and downs. But it's certainly we are fortunate in that I think everybody who's here kind of gets it. You know, I don't get a lot of calls. We get emails once in a while from people who are wondering what's going on, but the fact that we try to be so transparent about it all, I think certainly helps. People can tell, you know, you're working at it, you're trying hard. It's just, you know, it doesn't always go your way, and let's be patient and grind it out here.
Yeah. Yeah. And I find myself in that conversation a bit just with diversification in general, you know, past few years, even international struggled past 7 or 8 years relative to the US bonds have. So, mm-hmm. You know, people tie to that S&P 500. So it's a challenge to.
Yeah, I imagine. I mean, for you in particular, right? It's always that's the thing is if you have a properly diversified portfolio, then then there's really going to be something you can always point to on there and just look at and say, ugh, right?
Yeah,
but that's
yeah.
kind of the point.
Yeah, exactly.
Kind of how
exactly.
it's supposed to be, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, well, you know, talking about, you mentioned high frequency trading, the algorithms. So another thing that could be affecting, or I want your take on it. You know, I hear a lot of chatter that, well, so much more money now has gone to indexing, to the ETFs, mm-hmm. that at this point, sometimes the movement in the price of the stock is solely dependent on how many indexes it's in, and really not so much to the stock picker's analysis. Yeah, I mean, do you sort of kind of see that right now? Like, you see an obvious glaring issue, but a bad stock might go up because it's 4% of the index, or conversely, once things start to turn, are you going to have value companies that should do well, but they're going down because people are selling their ETFs and their index funds?
Yeah. No, that's a great point too. I feel like, first of all, yeah, I absolutely feel like, I mean, just anecdotally, I couldn't prove it to you, but it certainly feels like that is an issue. Let me back up. So I feel like, you know, 8, 9, 10 years ago, you know, if you saw a stock, any stock really moving, say more than 3 or 4% on a single day, you could usually attribute it to something fairly obvious, like, okay, a company had their earnings come out, there's a press release, or maybe a competitor had some news that was either, you know, good or bad for that particular company. So I would say anecdotally, though, I mean, these days, and I attribute this really to the rise of those ETFs, you will see a lot of volatility on an intraday basis in lots of stocks that it seems completely uncorrelated with anything material on the news side. And while it's certainly possible that there maybe, you know, some brokerage has issued a report and it's not widely distributed, there might be a way to attribute larger moves in stocks to still rational things. It just feels like over time, you know, they're just getting a lot more, you're seeing a lot more intraday volatility for no real reason. And in my mind, one of the possible and sort of likely reasons that is just that point, the sort of the rise of ETFs and the fact that there's just a lot of programmatic buying going on that is completely uncorrelated with everything except the fact that, okay, somebody out there, either institutions or the retail folks are buying a particular ETF that owns those same shares. So I think it sure feels like a clear risk in there somewhere, and specifically that, you know, most people have really no idea that something like those FANG stocks is represented as such a huge percentage of, you know, any sort of S&P 500 index ETF. What that risk could result in, or, you know, what the catalyst could be that might spark, you know, that fact is actually something potentially unpleasant, I don't quite know. That's a little bit harder to say. But it does seem a little bit unbalanced against in general, and you know that it is in the back of my mind. At the same time, you know, I guess I don't necessarily feel I need a lot of conviction in answering how big a problem that is, because at least in theory, you know, value stocks would be among the least affected in that. If you know, one of the drivers of Facebook's rise over the last 6-7 years has been simply because it's in every, you know, broad range ETF. Okay, well, then that being more of a growth stock for sure isn't necessarily going to impact us as directly. So, you know, from that sort of old-fashioned stock picking sort of approach where you're just looking at select undervalued companies at the other end of the spectrum from some of those more fully or overvalued FANG stocks, I think that ETF problem is most likely going to be an issue more for allocators, frankly, than value investors specifically. But it is, I think, a perceptive, open-ended question about what does this really mean? And I don't know that I really have fully thought through what that could be, other than, boy, this seems odd, and I don't think people realize this.
Yeah. But, and the other thing I'd like to get your feedback on, so you know, we also have the Federal Reserve now starting to drain some liquidity from the economy, you know, whether it's through raising interest rates and the Federal Reserve rate, or probably even more importantly, starting to sell assets on their balance sheet. So we're seeing liquidity start to be pulled out. What do you think the impact will be on the market with this, or just in general other asset classes too? I mean, do you kind of have a thought on that?
Yeah, I guess it ties back a little bit to that earlier discussion about what might trigger that shift from growth to value. And, you know, as you increase the discount rate you use in any sort of company valuation model, then, you know, the valuation is going to come down. That's just sort of how kind of finance works, I suppose. And Buffett is, as you would imagine, a much simpler, more folksy analogy, something about, you know, interest rates are to stock valuations like, you know, gravity is to apples, something along those lines. So that could be the case, that once rates get to a certain point, then maybe it's a further reckoning in terms of how fully valued some of these technology companies may be. More broadly, I guess, I don't know that part of the value being out of favor for an extended period of time thesis almost certainly ties into the fact that, you know, the world has been awash in liquidity for a good 9-10 years now. I think the more sort of concerning for me in general than interest rates would really be, you know, things, well, the federal deficit and debt in general, and that sort of in terms of the economic front, you know, independent of oil and you know, what may happen in that sector specifically, that's kind of my next area of economic concern, I guess, would be the federal deficit in general. And then, you know, that absolutely ties into rates as well. And there's a whole, you know, a sort of spider web of possibilities that could result from things under that whole header, if you will. Assuming the Fed does not unintentionally over tighten, then, you know, it just seems to be one of those, okay, this is the playing field that we're on. Let's figure out how to adapt. And as I look a little further out, then that's probably the next big, big issue specifically. But yeah, it's absolutely been easy, I think, to be a growth investor when everything is going up, you know, whether it's tech stocks or the, you know, 3 weeks ago, it's the pot stocks. And to some extent, you know, the fact that the world has been awash in liquidity has contributed to that. So by definition, if that liquidity starts to be drained, then yeah, all right, there would seem to maybe be something causal down the road, not too too far too, that we ought to be thinking about. Yeah.
Yeah, I kind of think that that's going to be, you know, use the phrase Buffett always says, you can tell who's swimming naked when the tide goes out. It just seems like liquidity is going to be that tide that at some point, you know, people are going to be scrambling for swimsuits. And I mean, you have to think that value has got to be one area that people are going to go, I would think. But then you can even look at most value stocks, the traditional value stocks, and they're kind of at all-time high valuations on their own. It's just crazy environment.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, no, it's been tough to, I think, find, you know, as this sort of bull market has gone on, it's I guess, a good problem to have in that it's harder to find truly, you know, classically undervalued, high-quality companies. And, you know, that doesn't look like it's going to change anytime soon, short of some sort of, you know, resumption, or at least maybe the end of the cycle finally. And we will have to, I guess, wait and see how it all plays out. But it does feel like, anyways, that maybe there's a little bit too much complacency or comfort, at least, about a lot of things in the market that, you know, 10 years ago, you and I might have been more concerned about, or at least not have been so alone in our concern. There have been other people saying similar things like, is anybody watching the deficit here? That sort of thing.
Well, so I'd like to get your feedback. Want to do kind of a separate show on this, and I wish I'd have kind of got this podcast going a few years ago, specifically on Elon Musk and Tesla. So I've always kind of had the position that, you know, Wall Street has been too much in love with Musk. I mean, anything, any idea he got, they loved it. They throw cash at him. The valuation on Tesla was, you know, on a per car produced basis was just ridiculous compared to Ford and GM and Toyota. So I've been arguing for years, like it's a charade, you know, it's something's going to happen here at some point. Gravity is going to affect him as well. Again, I'm probably a little late here because it seems like it's already starting to get to him, but just wondering what your thought is he just a mad genius that's going to change the world, or is he basically running the business into the ground?
Yeah. And you're right. This could easily be its own separate podcast. I guess I would disclaim up front that I have not looked at Tesla much at all recently. I mean, the last time I looked really anything beyond a superficial check was probably 2 or 3 years ago. But, you know, at that time, Tesla was losing literally $4,000 on every car they manufactured, which is clearly unsustainable. And that also explains probably why, Wall Street tends to throw a lot of love at the company because they need a lot of financing. I have some, I guess, real questions about their balance sheet just at sort of a superficial level. Once they did the deal with SolarCity, it seemed a little bit odd or unusual. And it's an open question in my mind is how much of that is really going to, how much of the debt, for instance, from a SolarCity acquisition is going to really plague them. I don't do a lot on Twitter these days, but when I do check in, it seems like my Twitter feed is almost overwhelmed with Tesla shorts. So there's no shortage of either conspiracy theories or mixed in with some, you know, pretty good analytical points that while I haven't spent a lot of time myself, you know, knowing there are some smart fellows out there really taking a good look and asking these questions is meaningful to me. I feel like it is a little bit of a dichotomy, I guess. I mean, you got to root for Elon just strictly as, you know, an American entrepreneurial success story. And there's, I completely agree, there's not too many minds out there who can kind of do what he has done. But at the same time, Tesla has some real profitability issues. They seem to have some real operational issues. And even a level above that, I argue they have some real general management issues. I feel like one of the bigger problems that Tesla is probably looking at here is they really need to turn the reins over to some serious operators. I think Elon, he is probably one of the greatest sort of startup guys in history, but I would not overlook or undersell the importance of really, really good management teams. It's, you know, those sort of back office boring skills that, you know, border on the bureaucratic, but that you absolutely want and need to have at certain companies in order for them to really, you know, kind of grow and in Tesla's case, get anything close to sort of fulfilling what its potential might be. So, you know, it's that trap, right? I feel like they need to have more serious operational financial help, but, you know, that stock absolutely has a big Elon premium in it right now. So, you know, it's, it'd be a tough board to be on at the moment just because, you know, they've got to figure out how to thread that needle and maybe get some real help in there without giving Elon the complete hook. But arguably, for the sake of that business, that would seem to be the most rational approach, at least from, you know, from the cheap seats where I am. A lot of ways this conversation could go. but it is probably emblematic of you know, there being a certain segment of investor the last, you know, 8-9 years to whom valuation hasn't mattered at all. And frankly, you know, on paper, okay, well, they've been right, at least when it comes to Tesla. I don't even know where it's trading today, but in general, you know, that's been a sort of winning trade and then some. But I'm with you. I'm a little, I guess, skeptical for a couple of reasons, even though, you know, all right, got to root for Elon, but let's put that aside and focus on this as a real business. And they have some serious concerns and an unclear way to solve them, frankly.
So if you, you know, being an investor, you're going to have to kind of put some money into this. What do you think is probably the more viable option, that either, you know, 5 years from now that somehow Musk pulls it out and is able to lead the company to, you know, solid financial footing, or B, does a larger competitor, a Toyota or something, come in and buy, or C, do you think the board makes the tough decisions, kind of either puts him into the corner and then brings in the team that you're talking about and kind of rights a ship? I mean, what do you think? And again, nobody knows, but if you had to put money down, you know, it's part of your investment process. Which path would you kind of take?
Yeah, I guess I would probably start by ruling out the ones that wouldn't work and see what's left. Specifically, I think option C, or that pathway C, is probably not going to happen. If, put it this way, if the board didn't react to his tweeting about being private and then, you know, showing up on people's podcasts, smoking blunts, you know, like if they're not going to remove him then that ship is probably, I mean, they're probably, you know, to some extent, I don't know, compromise. I don't know what the right word is, but clearly, you know, you should not rely on that board to make any meaningful, hard decisions about Elon specifically. On that option B, or that second pathway, it does seem most likely to me, and maybe this supports some of the premium in that stock, is that Tesla will either sell itself or be acquired, or be approached about being acquired at some point. The problem there, however, is, you know, again, there's for any rational acquirer, there is a huge gap between that bid ask, right? Between what, mm-hmm. you know, Elon and or Tesla would probably be willing to sell itself for and what it's worth. So how that plays out, well, that kind of remains to be seen. I think the least likely option of the remaining on the table are that he stays and, you know, 5 years later sorts of just decides to, he can figure it out. I just don't know. Again, I think he's brilliant at many things, but I'm not sure operational excellence and management is sort of near the top of that list. So, you know, while I suppose there are maybe some in-between scenarios where maybe SoftBank steps up with, you know, $50 billion and they give him a great term sheet on how they would have, and maybe there's a way that he can kind of stay at the helm and maneuver him through things. But, you know, I'm not sure the guy is necessarily acting super rationally now, and at some point, just as a fiduciary, either on that board or maybe as a big institution who owned a lot of shares, I feel like that's a conversation that probably needs to happen about Elon. So, yeah, it's hard to say. That's kind of how I'd handicap each of those three options, you know, with the most likely outcome probably being that they get acquired at some point. But, you know, when that happens and what shape the company's in at that point, I guess I would summarize and say, I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon because they have some real issues here. So if it did happen, that would be further down the road a little bit too.
Okay.
But sure is fun to speculate about. I don't know. And, you know, the other option could be, well, they just bite off more than they can chew, and or at some point, I guess it's feasible they could run out of cash. You know, there's all sorts of sort of spiraling scenarios there that I couldn't speak to intelligently on at the moment, but won't stop me from speculating about.
We'll finish up with just a couple other general questions. So we, you know, you've talked about Buffett. You certainly have admiration for him. But what would you say? I, you know, when I look at him too, I also kind of think that you get all these folksy, you know, your great uncle, great advice, that kind of stuff. But if you actually look at what he's doing, it's almost the opposite of what some of the advice he gives. Do you think there's any kind of, you know, two-facedness to him a little bit?
No, well, I guess I back up. I don't know that. Let me step back a little bit. I think, again, his framework of investing in particular, I feel like is hugely important, you know, both sort of for me personally, I guess, and other people in this industry that I kind of really admire on the stock picking side, and on the street in general. You know, I do think he sort of generally represents some sincere moral leadership on a few things at times, but I guess, like you, I'm not necessarily sure that folksy narrative about him, really like any narrative, should be completely believed. So as an investor, yeah, I think he has a ton to offer. As a person, I'm not so sure that I would model my own behavior, for instance, at home on his or anywhere necessarily outside that investment field, not necessarily because of anything nefarious, but it's because at the end of the day, he is, well, like everyone, he's sort of inherently self-interested. And I it reminds me of, so back in 2010, I went to the Berkshire meeting, you know, one of those guys who goes out to Omaha and sits in the Quest Center with whatever, 50,000 people, and just and that 2010 meeting was unique in that of the many things I remember, the thing that sticks out most prominently was the first question he got asked at that meeting, and it was about Goldman Sachs, which had, you know, a couple weeks before the meeting, quite literally just been sued by the SEC for fraud related to the CDOs that they were selling. And you'll remember back then that Berkshire had bought, I think it was about $5 billion worth of preferreds from Goldman back in 2008. And I guess the short version is that he defended them pretty strongly at that meeting, which, you know, kind of always sat a little uncomfortable with me. Not necessarily in terms of, you know, the defense itself, but, okay, here is the U.S. SEC suing these people, you know, for fraud on what would be a fairly large scale. And I just kind of felt like, yeah, I would have handled that differently. I don't know that I would have defended these guys as vociferously as Buffett and Munger did. And, you know, the obvious thing to point to is, okay, well, they are certainly there. They have a $5 billion investment at the time. So, you know, I guess I can rationalize why they said what they did, but it seemed to be one of those little flags in the back of my head that said, hey, you know what, it's let's just keep this guy's investing framework in mind. Might not necessarily be, for example, the moral leader that is sometimes attributed to him, and in general in life, that probably serves it pretty well. But
sure.
I think, you know, it's funny. I feel like he also has created, it's almost the Michael Jordan problem. Like, they both, Buffett and Jordan, you know, they will probably forever be remembered as the best in their respective fields because they were both so successful that, you know, they launched and inspired so many other people to come behind them who were also able to raise their game. That just, you know, the competition got so intense after, you know, in both basketball and investing, after both those guys went through and stood out as much as they did, that they've almost sort of assured their place at the top of that pedestal forever because, you know, there's just so many more people competing and trying that, you know, it's just that much harder or near possible to reach that same level of success, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. And then we'll just finish off with one other quick question, but if you could go back to the, you know, 22-year-old Kale, you know, Boot Ensign, what what would you tell him to do differently with his money? And I'm not so much looking for, hey, buy Apple stock or, you know, something like that, but, yeah. but more of a, like a, you know, personal finance habit or something you wish you had done that you didn't do.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, well, I mean, it's not super insightful or sexy or anything, but I think just putting that investing on autopilot. I mean, just starting early, putting a little bit away every month, even no matter how small it might be, and just kind of prioritize that by having it, you know, automatically coming out of your checking account, and keeping that going, really without having to think about it. And, you know, once you have kids, your household cash flows are going to get reprioritized a lot anyways. But, you know, it's just that magic of compounding. The earlier you start, and really, it's just simply a stunning amount how big the difference will be, you know, 20 years later. So if I could go back to, you know, the 22-year-old Kale, I'd say, yeah, you know what, just get that set up and going. And even if it were to just go in an index fund until something truly compelling on the stock-specific side popped up, you're still going to be so far ahead than, you know, kind of just wait around until I have enough to make it meaningful to then go do the work. And like I said, then I'll just get it going. That's that'd probably be my my advice to myself back then. Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's great advice. So yeah, Kale, I appreciate your time. Appreciate your insight. It's great.
Yeah, absolutely.
If
fun.
If people wanted to connect with you, like what's the best way to connect?
Yeah, easiest is probably just through the company. If you Google Isla Morada Investment Management with the silent S in there, then we should hopefully pop up near the top. Yeah, plenty of marketing propaganda out there on the web for sure.
Okay, great. Again, thanks a lot, and we'll talk to you later.
Okay, thanks, Kirk. Appreciate it.
Well, that's it for this episode of the Saving Yourself from Wall Street podcast. I appreciate you stopping in. As always, you can find our podcast along with other articles and videos at savingyourselffromwallstreet.com. And now, the lawyers say hi.
Saving Yourself from Wall Street is hosted by Kirk Kinder. Kirk Kinder is the owner of Picket Fence Financial, a fee-only financial planning firm. Picket Fence Financial is regulated by the states of Maryland and Florida in accordance and in compliance with securities laws and regulations. Picket Fence Financial does not render or offer to render personalized financial or tax advice through the Saving Yourself from Wall Street podcast. The information provided is for informational purposes only and does not constitute financial, tax, investment, or legal advice.